Tobias Carlyle is the founder and principal of Acquires Funds. For regulatory reasons, we will not discuss any of the Acquires Funds on this podcast. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Acquires Funds or affiliates. For more information, visit acquiresfunds.com.
This week's Acquirers podcast is brought to you by my good friends at Validia. Validia runs quantitative stock selection models using strategies based on academic papers and books with long-term track records of success. You may recognize Validia since two of its founders, Jack Forehand and Justin Carboneau, both good friends of mine, have appeared as guests on the podcast. With value stocks showing signs of turning around, Validia offers more than 10 systematic value models backed by long-term research, including strategies based on Joseph Piotrowski's F-score, Ben Graham's defensive investor from The Intelligent Investor, Joel Greenblatt's magic formula, the value composite from Jim O'Shaughnessy's What Works on Wall Street, and many others. Investors can access these strategies through concentrated 10 and 20 stock model portfolios or see how stocks rank based on each model's specific investment criteria. Through the end of March, Validia is offering 33% off an annual subscription to both its standard and professional product to listeners of the Acquirers podcast. To find out more about Validia or to take a free trial, you can go to validia.com/Toby. Again, that's validia.com/Toby. Hey, it's Tobias here. If you want to learn a little bit about my firm or see my portfolio, head on over to acquirersfunds.com.
Oh, yeah, that would be pretty cool to watch.
What's up, amigos? It is Value After Hours. It's 10:30 a.m. on the West Coast, 1:30 p.m. on the East Coast. It's 5:30 p.m. UTC, 5:30 a.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time. We are live. If you want to come and watch us live, go to the YouTube channel for the Acquirers podcast and click to get notifications. It'll let you know. What's happening, gents? It's a one-year anniversary of the bottom.
Generational buying opportunity 1 year ago today.
Crazy. This is the best that your 12-month look back's going to look. So screenshot it.
It's all crap from here.
Pump out all the marketing material today.
That's right.
Get it out.
That's what I'm doing.
Good luck with the tech. Thanks. Fingers crossed, everybody. Now that doesn't go down. So I got a good topic for today. It's JP Morgan has this article, The Agony and the Ecstasy. It's about concentrated stock portfolios and how many businesses fail. How many companies fail in the Russell 3000 came via the Irrelevant Investor. So I appreciated the link there. What are you guys talking about today?
I'll probably just piggyback on you and then talk about the power of doing nothing.
How's that fit into your epic rant that is on deck?
I don't know how epic it'll be. We'll see.
Let's find something to get you wound up.
I'm plenty wound. I just don't know how wound I want to get.
It's 4:30 a.m. in Melbourne. Sorry, I might have got those times wrong. I guess you're on your own. Don't listen to me.
All right. I have a little piece prepared. Did I say that right? Piece prepared for that's called A Beautiful Portfolio. And this is going to be talking about some of Paul Graham's work. So,
good name.
Maybe
should I'll take it away because I've got the conch and I'm always lazy and I finally prepared something, so here I go.
Yes.
So that nice bit, the it's a JP Morgan paper, The Agony and the Ecstasy, The Risks and Rewards of a Concentrated Stock Position. They looked in the Russell 3000. Basically 40% of Russell 3000 companies have negative absolute returns, so you'd have been better off holding cash in that instance. And so the reason that I wanted to highlight it, because I think that this is potentially something you could put into your list of just stuff to be careful of. They listed out what are the primary reasons for business failure, and so the first one is commodity price risks that cannot be hedged away. So we probably already knew that, so just be careful of the commodity businesses. Government policy. This is a really long one. That just about anything that they can change can hurt you, including re-regulation and deregulation. So when the Fed's moving around, you just got to, when the federal government's moving around, you got to be a little bit careful there. Intellectual property infringement by domestic or foreign firms. Foreign competitors whose market share is magnified by government subsidies. The impact of patent trolls. Changes in US or foreign government tariff or trade policy. Fraud by non-executive employees. A shift in buying power to the firm's customers resulting from consolidation. Unconstrained expansion by competitors. So I don't know how useful that list is, but it's just kind of an interesting...
Everything
that can go wrong.
D, all of the above.
I don't know how much of that you could identify prospectively. Like, maybe be careful of commodity businesses. Maybe be careful of businesses that are heavily regulated or not regulated at all. I don't know. I don't think that there's anything that...
Or somewhere in between.
Be careful of patent trolls, which means that you're the copyright infringer. Also be careful of infringing, of like having your copyright infringed.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like businesses that aren't particularly moaty could go out of business. Sort of my takeaway.
Well, how do you assess a moat? That's a good question.
Well, I mean, I think that, like, you know, I mean, I spent the morning reading about TransDigm, right? So this person that was talking about it was talking about how they generally in aerospace, if you own the IP, that's a pretty good place to play. And one of the things that makes it tough for a lot of people to compete in aerospace is like you need to be able to invest the money today in anticipation of the back end, right? So like the upfront development costs on the platform are not where you're making much of your money at all. So you're making it on the back end, but then if you own the IP, like, and you're the sole source, I mean, that's pretty moaty, I would think.
What's an example of that?
Well, TransDigm.
But in just specifically, like, what's the, what are they doing?
Well, they're making
aftermarket,
like, small...
aren't they?
No, I mean, that's where they make a lot of their money, but they integrate themselves in the supply chain up front. And then on the back end, they're the people that own the IP, and they tend to be like the sole source of small ticket item, like small dollar value, single source,
toilets,
highly engineered parts.
So when the OEMs are developing their thing, they come in and they say, we'll help you. They are integral to that process of developing whatever it is and say, we'll supply the parts. And then down the road...
Yeah, they'll make like little antennas. They'll make like the, little seatbelt buckle stuff. They'll make something that you put wires through that goes into in the cockpit and whatever. So... it's like little stuff that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to once it's already on a plane. And certainly as it's long into the life cycle, it doesn't make sense to like stand up a secondary manufacturing plant that then you need to have like go through all the FAA regulations and it's not so easy to copy. Where like I think HEICO goes after sort of easier to copy parts. TransDigm focuses on stuff that's like more highly engineered and smaller ticket size.
A bit like sugar in the US where we pay like 2x the world's normal price for sugar. Mostly I think due to some kind of tariffs or something, but nobody notices or cares because it's like, what's your annual sugar budget? You know, it rounds to zero, so no one cares.
Does that support high fructose corn syrup or something like that?
I'm thinking like of actual real like granulated sugar, but...
But isn't that like one's a substitute for the other, so you keep sugar expensive and it makes the other one kind of competitive? I don't know, I'm just asking.
I'd be interested to see a list of the companies that went out of business. I mean...
It's 40% of the Russell 3000.
It's a long list.
Yeah, I understand. But I guess what I'm saying is like, you know, we talk about, oh, well, the Russell is trading at a cheap valuation relative to the NASDAQ. I would be interested to know how many of those companies are tech.
Well, that's 3000, not the 2000. It's all of them. It's the top 3,000. Okay. It's not necessarily like a small cap versus NASDAQ. NASDAQ's quite big these days.
I guess I just want to know, I mean, which of the companies. I'd like to see a list. I know it's a long list. I get it. 1,200 companies.
Long and distinguished.
I would be interested to know what the multiple was before they went in.
I'd be curious sometimes to see how moody they were at one point in their lives.
Yeah.
Kodak.
Big moat.
At one stage,
You know, people like make joke of that. How long could you have invested in Kodak? Like, yes, I agree, the last year would have been bad, but Kodak had like a pretty good run.
Yeah.
If you were early in Kodak, I don't think that you were like, oh, fuck, it went out of business eventually.
It was a nifty 50.
Yeah.
But isn't that saying, like, it's not when you fall out of a high window, it's not the fall that kills you. It's just that last little bit where you hit the ground at the bottom.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't know. I don't know how much of this is like, could you own businesses and monitor them and then see some of this coming, right? And like, yeah, you're going to take a markdown at some point, but
what would you look for?
I don't know. I mean, you got to look at KPIs, I guess. Like for TransDigm, you certainly wouldn't want to see a secondary player enter the market, right? That kind of busts the whole thesis. For cable, I think you want to see how they're taking share of, you know, other customers. And if people started to take share from them, I probably wouldn't stick around to see why with all the leverage. I don't know. I think every situation is pretty different, right? I think with beer, probably people would have said, you know, when the volume decline started, you didn't want to really hang out, especially in Bud. I mean, I did, but it was a loser, so...
I mean, Bud's a tough one, right? Because it was Buffett bought some Bud in like 2005, I want to say, before the acquisition. When did beer really start being a declining industry, or macro beer start being a declining industry?
When he bought it, it was already declining.
I mean, that's what creates the opportunity, right? But then you got Sam. I looked at Sam was cheap. Maybe 2 years ago, something like that. And Sam's had a monster run since then.
Yeah. Well, Truly took off too, right? So that helps.
That's the hard seltzer's done it.
Yeah. I don't know if it's done it, but I think that's some of what's going on there.
I think there's a lot more randomness.
You gotta monitor this stuff. How do you know anything?
Well, that's what I think. That's kind of my position. Like that, I saw there was a question about Dan Rasmussen saying that, you know, you can't really, moats don't help much. That's sort of my view that, like, for most companies, there's like 96% of companies, there's no real decent moat in there. It's just there's a 4% that do seem to be pretty persistent. But I think they're almost each one of them is like a unique situation. I don't know how much of a lesson you can draw from it. You know, it's sort of each one is unique for its own.
Have you been on Twitter? There's moats everywhere. Every company has moats. They're all moaty.
It does look that way. There are some moats out there, though. I just don't know if you can draw broad lessons from it. I think that it's like a...
And if you disagree, check the stock price.
That is true. It's been a good run for moaty businesses. All right, I feel like we've thrashed this one to death. What do you got, JT?
Have we? I don't know. I mean, just so yeah, Paul Graham, who I don't. Do you guys have much experience with any of his work or ideas?
Yeah, when I was a tech M&A lawyer in San Francisco, someone gave me his book. Just the name of it escapes me at the moment. So it's been a long time since I've read it.
Is it Hackers and
Yes,
Bankers?
That's the one. I've got that back there somewhere. I love the book, and I read his. I read his website when he puts up a new essay. I found them to be pretty insightful. I think he's an interesting thinker.
I have no idea who he is.
Good. All right. So, well, just as a little background then, for Bill's sake and everyone else maybe. So Paul Graham is he's a computer scientist, essayist, and venture capital guy now in that he was one of the founders of Y Combinator. So he's probably doing okay, but he has this book, Hackers and Painters, and it's it's quite good. Like, there's I mean, some of the talk about like programming languages might not be as interesting for someone, although there
he
are
advocates
some
Ruby
cool...
on Rails right over C++ or whatever it was.
Not quite right, but yeah.
What
he likes
was
this one called Lisp is
Lisp,
the
okay.
programming language
okay.
that he likes, but
it's been a long time since
so
I read
in
it.
Chapter 9 of the book, it's called Taste for Makers, and it's actually available on his website too if you want to read that section. But you know, he's talking about how like mathematicians will call good work like beautiful, and it kind of has its own meaning, and other domains have also sort of adopted the idea of beautiful, whether it's you know, scientists or engineers or musicians or architects, designers, writers, and coders. So he looks through all these different domains and tries to draw out the similarities of really like how do you make good stuff? And so I thought, well, all right, we can start with where, you know, these the different domains that he saw and how do they make good stuff there? And he took it to then kind of computer programming, and we can then take it one step farther and try to apply it to a portfolio or investing more broadly. So he has like 14 different sort of axioms about what makes something beautiful, but we'll pick out a handful of them and see if we can get through them and see what interesting things come out of it. But so number one, good design is simple. So in math, a shorter proof is always better. You know, good computer programming is very tight. Good writing is concise. And, you know, Hemingway wrote at like a fifth grade level, right? Like Toby, I mean, maybe talk a little bit about like some of your experience with writing and simplification.
Yeah, my first three books were written probably where I normally write. And then Acquire is Multiple. I read that after the Second World War, they discovered that a lot of the guys who were on the boats, the naval boats, couldn't read the manuals because they were written by engineers, and the guys who were expected to operate them in many cases, you know, were unqualified to some degree. And so they went and they standardized writing to work out what are the indications of, so if someone can read to a fifth grade level or a 10th grade level, and basically it's the number of syllables in a sentence, the number of syllables in a word, the number of words in a sentence, and they have different scales of measuring it, and basically it determines how complex or how complicated your writing is and how many years of education you need to be able to understand it. And so what they've then found is they've gone and they've looked at, you know, famous writers and see what level they write to, and there's a pretty strong correlation between the lower the grade level and the more commercially successful your book. So Harry Potter is written to a very low grade level, and it's one of the most successful books around. Dan Brown writes to a fifth grade reading level. Ernest Hemingway got a Nobel Prize for Literature, writes to a fifth grade reading level. I find Ernest Hemingway a little bit hard to read, but you know, Dan Brown, it's a page turner. They're very short chapters. But so basically, the more complex your writing, the fewer people who can read it, the less commercially successful you are. I think it's a, and I found that to be true too. Acquire as Multiple is much more successful as a book. It's also cheaper. So there's that.
And I think the good writing has a crispness to it as well. That is, you know, there's an economization of words that really, like, the English language is rich enough that you can, there's almost a right word that you can pick that will eliminate two to three other words that, you know, would be descriptive to help try to craft the sentence. And so taking this to an investment context, I think, you know, a good investment thesis is simple and, you know, it's kind of back of the napkin, doesn't have a lot of moving parts that can, you know, if any one of those links in the chain breaks and it destroys your whole thesis, you know, that's a lot more fragile than a very simple back of the envelope kind of calculation and idea, which is why I actually find like a lot of macro things really compelling. But also I'm very cognizant of the fact that you need like 12 different things to all happen in the right order for this whole like magical puzzle to pop out that, you know, here's how you would win.
So I put that to, you know, Jason, who runs Mutiny Fund, I said to him, that's the problem that I've always seen with macro is that the idea might be compelling, but it's like it's all in series. This needs to happen. This needs to happen. This needs to happen. By the time you got six things in series where it's just a coin flip, the number of possible outcomes is so huge, it's really hard to get paid. And he said, yes, but that's the way to make the bet really convex. So I was like, that's kind of interesting that you can put on a more blunt version of it and probably be more likely to get some return. But if you put on that one that, you know, if you can narrow it down to like, oh, we're, you know, I've got this thesis that something's going to happen in Japan, so I want to be like short JGB, you know, vol puts or calls or something, whatever they're trying to, you know, if they're doing it to that level, that's because, so Carl Bass can say, this is the most convex trade I've ever seen in my life, like that kind of stuff.
You get three sevens in a row on your slot machine.
That's it. You know, get really all the get cherries. Paid. All the cherries came up.
Bill, any thoughts on simplification in your investing world?
Yeah, I just think a whole lot of hard needs to get you to the simple part.
We'll get to that a little bit more. So next thing, good design is timeless. And, you know, in math, every proof is timeless unless it has some kind of error in it, right? Almost by definition, good proofs are timeless. Kelly Johnson, who was a manager and kind of like brains behind the Skunk Works projects that produced the U2 and the SR-71, said that, you know, an airplane that looks beautiful will fly beautifully. And, you know, and I think like if you look at the SR-71, like to me, that's like a really timeless looking airplane. Like it still looks badass, even though it's what, like 60 years old or something.
But didn't they say about those things that there were two problems with them, right? They didn't fly, and I might be wrong about the SR-71. That's the Blackbird, right? I can't remember which one's which. I read that book too, and he said there are two things that really bothered him. They just sat on the, you know, they were designed at some sort of pressure, so they assumed that they'd get up into the air and all of the metal would expand. But basically, while they sat on the tarmac, they just leaked all over the place. It may not have been the SR-71, it might have been like later the stealth fighters, but he said basically you can't fly them, you need a computer to help you fly them, because otherwise they're just not aerodynamic, they just fall through this, they're like rocks that fall through the sky that a computer flies for you.
All right, well, they still look badass, so don't ruin that part for me.
I think that's also true of the boats don't, I don't know what I'm talking about, but it's interesting.
So one of the nice things about being timeless is that it's sort of in a way to evade fashion, right? And, you know, when you – like he references sort of – he doesn't call it the Lindy effect, but it's a little bit like that. But if you design something that would appeal to someone in the 1500s, it has a better chance of appealing to someone in 2500. So, like, you know, a good drawing or, you know, a good painting.
Ruffles around the neck.
Yeah, right. So that's a little bit more fashion. So I think, you know, like for me, like the timelessness in an investment context in a portfolio is really like, you know, a well-run kind of long duration minded business that, and really like focusing on cash flows and actually like cash, as you know, cash sometimes is important in the investment world and other times it doesn't matter as much, but I think that is a bit of a fashion as well. But I think over the long term, like you can anchor to the fact that, you know, good cash flow producing business in 2500 is still going to be important, just like it was in 1500. And although we forget about it occasionally, in it's more fashionable to, you know, be not really worried about cash sometimes. But I think it's always a touchstone for me to come back to.
Let me play devil's advocate for a moment, because one of the great articles that you did your veggies on a little while back was the, you know, how long something had survived and how long it was like, this is the Lindy test. And so somebody had done this analysis and they had said that basically the length of time that something has been alive is like an irrelevant factor for how long it continues to survive. So Lindy is not right.
I think Lindy, if we're being like strict about it, is that if you know nothing else about something, you have to assume that you're somewhere in the middle of the life of it, just statistically speaking. The odds that you're at the beginning or the end are probably less likely, which leads you to the middle, which then means that it's about half of its life right now.
Damn, that's good.
All right, the next thing is, and this goes back to you, Bill, with, you know, good design is hard. And, you know, in math, like the difficult proofs are, they require a lot of ingenious thinking and solving, ingenious solutions. You know, a small budget is what will produce a really elegant design. A lot of times the constraint is what creates the creativity. But that's not easy, right? And the best art has always been the painting of people. And so, like, you could paint a tree, and if one of the arms of the tree, you know, the branches of the tree is off by 5 degrees, like, no one's going to notice or really care because it just sort of is like, all right, well, that's just what that tree looks like. But if you paint someone and you're off by 5 degrees as far as, like, their, you know, where their eyes are, like, that's very noticeable, right? So, you know, and that's not easy to do, obviously. So, and the other thing, too, is, like, you know, wild animals, he says, are beautiful because they live hard lives. Which I think is kind of a nice thing to say, or it's interesting. So in this investment context, and you guys can fill in more here, but, like, to me, you know, it requires a lot of research to understand a company. Like, it's not always easy. It's hard. And it's, you know, if this game is too easy to you, I have to kind of wonder about, like, do you really understand some of the risks that you might be taking? And of course, you know, your psychology is always going to be tested in this. Maybe like few other pursuits. You know, it really is you against yourself a lot of times.
I think it's always you against yourself. There's nothing else there.
Yeah, I like Elliot Turner's concept of like a malevolent Mr. Market.
Malevolent, like, or benevolent?
Yeah.
Malevolent?
Malevolent. Yeah, getting tongue twisted.
The mean one, the evil one.
He's trying to get you to act the wrong way.
Huh. Yeah. All right. Good design uses symmetry. So a lot of this is like repetition and recursion. And you see that a lot in nature, right? Like, there's a lot of repetition that's used, kind of fractal patterns, things like that. If you look at the Eiffel Tower, it's actually like a tower on top of a tower. And that's a kind of a recursive idea. So, you know, for me in the investment context, that is, I think, a lot of times, like, sort of pattern recognition. Like, you've done a particular kind of investment, or you recognize something about a business and it looks similar to something else that you've been successful with, or maybe not successful, and you learn that lesson and you learn to avoid it then. And then, you know, I think there's also maybe kind of an interesting argument to be made there with symmetry about equal weighting of positions and the humility of that. So, thoughts on that?
I don't know. I've never bet big and lost yet, so I'll let you know when that happens.
Gauntlet thrown down.
No, I'm not trying to be like an ass about it. It's just like, I bet big a couple times, and I bet big on Trans Diamond March. I bet big on Curate when I told everyone I was doing it. You know, so I don't know. I haven't bet big and lost. So maybe if I take a big loss, then I'll change my opinion. But thus far, my higher weighted bets, I bet big on Charter. Like, things have worked out when I bet big. So I have a hard, it's not easy for me to understand the concept of an equal weighted portfolio if I'm spending all this time to try to figure out when a bet is worth making.
Symmetry is tough. I can't really imagine how you apply that at this point. I got to think about that a little bit more. But maybe that does make sense in a portfolio. Maybe that is symmetry in a portfolio.
Well, let's see. I mean, Toby, you run. Well, long short is symmetry in some ways.
Yeah, it's a little bit unbalanced to be more to favor the long, but that's because the long tends to go up more often than the short goes down, than the short goes up.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that equal weighting is just what you say when you get down to you're already at the very pointy end of a big data set, and you're kind of just saying, out of all of these positions, I don't know which of these, at this pointy end are going to be the better ones. And I think it's hard going through that list. I've done that many times, looking back historically to try and work out, you know, not knowing what worked. It's hard to figure out which ones are the ones that are going to work. If you went through and, you know, cut out the tech, well, then you missed Microsoft and you missed some of the big winners. If you know, retail, you missed Ross Stores. If you have some sort of rule for things that you miss, like, I think possibly everybody else is doing the same thing. So I don't know. That's why I get to equal it.
Yeah. I mean, that is sort of, I mean, that was Joel Greenblatt's observation when people were given discretion over the Magic Formula picks and they all underperform just the unconstrained version of it.
It's tough. I don't know if that continues to apply, but it was a fairly short time period. That was the only thing. My 2 cents only ran for about 20 months.
Yeah. Next thing, good design resembles nature. This one is kind of obvious based on, you know, if you've listened to this show at all and our, you know, incessant use of nature for trying to explain things. But, you know, at the end of the day, it has to do with it. Nature has had a long time to optimize and had a lot of, it's a very large N. And so you get that big of a population size and that many observations, you can start to sort of trust that whatever comes out of it is true. So, you know, we don't need to really belabor the nature part of it because we do that every week. But so the next thing, I'll just move on. A good design is redesign. So, you know, apparently like Leonardo da Vinci basically invented sketching, you know, where it was like, it was a lot of like writing over things, moving a line a little bit. You know, it's just like constantly reworking it. And as you know, Toby, I'm sure you speak to this on writing, but like good writing is just like, it's total crap when it starts out. And, you know, like your first draft is such garbage and it's just the meticulous working it over and over the materials just until you almost hate the material as the author. that leads to eventually good writing. So you're just kind of sketching and then just relentless pressure on it to turn it into good writing.
Yeah, there's a good, it might even be Paul Graham who said it. He said something like, when you start out, you have better taste than you have skill. And so the first thing that you write down, and this is sort of through a career as well, but the first thing you write down or draw or paint or whatever is terrible. And then as you get better, your skill matches your taste. But it's also true for each individual thing that you do. The first draft is diabolically difficult to get out. And then it's really easy to go through and edit and rewrite. I mean, it's much, not really easy. It's easier than the first draft because the first draft is impossible. So you got to get the first draft out and down as quickly as you possibly can because it only starts getting better from there. So even if it's bad, it's better to have it out.
So, and in the investment context, I think sometimes people are guilty of getting the idea into their portfolio and then they sort of stop thinking about it and they stop sketching and they stop redesigning, they stop rewriting. It's just, well, that's one of my positions. Let's go look for another one, right? And, you know, to go to Ian Castle's point about, you know, he spends 80% of his time on the things that he owns to make sure he understands it. You know, that's sort of like the writing equivalent of, you know, of rewriting in the investment context. Like you kind of sketch it out at the beginning, but once you've owned it for a while, like that's your actual like rewriting over and over, resketching. And doing a better job of your matching your understanding with reality as you go. So I think that's kind of it's probably a pretty helpful idea to keep in mind.
Yeah, I really like that one too. I like Ian Castle's idea there, that you just keep on, the longer you hold it, the better you know it. So you're not going to get, you know, you're not going to sell out precipitously if something happens in it that if you studied it closely enough, you would have known that that was coming anyway. There's some small change. It's not really material. Sort of what we were talking about earlier, that you just need to follow the things that you own closely enough so that you can see if there's some change. I don't know if you can pick those things that are like potentially game ending for those businesses. Maybe you can. I don't know. Maybe you're paid to just, if you think that there's something that's going to be, if there's another competitor that's potentially game ending, maybe you hedge it by taking a small position in that competitor, knowing that by the time that competitor gets big enough to really damage your business, you've already got the stake, so you kind of you got a big enough size in each.
Yeah. That's the what if of like, why didn't Sears buy just 5% of Amazon when it was an early competitor, just to hedge a little bit of their own?
Taking a little bit of Netflix.
Sure.
As an investor, you can do that. You don't have to let the business doesn't have to do it for you. You can do it externally. Hedge your Blockbuster stake with the position in Netflix. That's kind of an interesting topic all by itself. I don't know if you can, might have to think about that one. How would you hedge all of the positions in your portfolio with the competitors?
Yeah, I don't think you want management running a hedge fund on your behalf.
But they kind of like are in Sears, some sense, aren't they?
Who knows the industry better,
Sears
though?
Got fucked because Sears sucked. Sears yeah. didn't get screwed because they didn't take a position in Amazon. They got screwed because they stopped investing in their business. You could walk through those aisles. They were full of shit. They got under inventory. They invested a bunch of money in a crap app. And, like, I'm sorry, I don't think a 5% position in Amazon was going to save them.
Wouldn't save them, but it might save you.
That money in a bad way.
As a Sears investor? As Sears, it wouldn't save them, but it might save you as a Sears investor or the Sears family.
Not, man, Lampert probably would have taken out some loan and, you know, put the shares in, leaned them up against ESL Investment Trust. Like, that's what he did with all the good real estate. Why wouldn't he have done it with the shares?
No, what I'm saying is you as an investor don't have to ride Sears all the way into the toilet. You can
buy it.
You can externally, you can say, well, Amazon's a real threat to this thing. I'm not prepared to sell out, but yeah. I'm going to buy this little thing over here.
Yeah, but I don't want
so
my
what would
management
you
teams
hedge your hedge your REIT with Zoom? Is that like a play?
Maybe. I think that's it's an interesting way to approach the problem.
I mean, you know, I don't know. I said that, like, I haven't taken a big loss on a big position. I guess the airlines were a big position. I did take a loss. I wonder if Zoom had sort of, like, cut in over time. Like, would I have been able to notice that I was in a melting ice cube? Like, I don't know. That's, like, a harder question for me to answer. I guess it was easier this time around because when the world stopped, I was just like, oh, this is clearly different. So, you know, I don't have a good answer simply because I don't have one.
All right. Well, I'm all done. I shot my wad. Whatever you guys want to talk about now.
Yeah. Well, I think it's kind of interesting. Like, you know, I mean, I agree with what Ian's saying. But then, you know, you got Charlie and Boyd, right? And he's – or BYD, and he's basically like, yeah, I'm just going to hold it. So, you know, like, I don't know. At what point – when do you act? It seems as though among most of the investors that I admire, price is not a valid reason to sell. And that seems to be a very, very consistent theme. So then you get to the question, well – who are all of the investors that held and then everything bombed out underneath them? But, I mean, Acree, Buffett, I mean, Malone flipped stuff. But, like, Munger, I mean, Munger said straight up, I don't understand why BYD is valued this way. Are you going to sell? Probably not. They're good at what they do. So, like, I don't know. It seems to me that price is a valid reason to buy. And more I read people that I seem to respect. Now, maybe this is just like a market cycle top. You know, I don't know. But you're talking about Buffett and Munger, Jake. I mean, so if you don't like them, then who's your role model? Because it's not as if I'm just like pointing to some crazy tech bro, right? I mean, I'm talking about Munger.
There's a good quote from Bill Gurley that I had put up today where he says, the power of compounding for these platforms is so huge. If you invest in an Amazon or whatever, the hardest thing to do is close your eyes and forget it. There's a little bit more to it than this, but his point is the only thing analysis is going to cause you to do is to sell the stock. So he's like, just close your eyes and just keep on holding.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you're wrong. I think it's if most of the returns come from a few huge winners and you go and truncate those winners by doing too much analysis and selling too early, then, and when those results that the business results come out that you could never have imagined in your wildest dreams, right? Like that is sort of what turns into those into those outcomes, yeah, I mean, it makes it really hard not to trim something that maybe you're better off ignoring and letting happen. But I do think there's probably got to be a lot of dead, quiet evidence in survivorship bias in this analysis, right?
I don't know. I mean, I've been talking about David Gardner for almost a year now. I mean, this is how his theory works. I think he probably looks for a bigger addressable market than I'm maybe used to, like, pushing myself to think to. But I think he swings at things he thinks he can really, really win, and then he holds them. And then he just lets math take over. Because if your upside is a $2 trillion company and your downside zero, then you can sort of mitigate that with a bet, right? If both are 1% going in and the upside is one, on one is, you know, whatever percent, infinite basically, and the other is down 100, as long as you can keep taking shots on goal, it's not the craziest strategy.
That's something that
I don't know why it outperforms an index. That's kind of hard for me to wrap my head around. But yeah.
I have been doing a little bit of that, like trying to work on some never sell ideas. And I did some, I've been doing testing of it where just as far back in my data set as I can go, just run the screen, see what happens if you hold it to today. And that's what happens. Like it starts looking more like a, a VC type portfolio where you have a handful of monster winners and you have plenty that go to zero. So, you know, if you think about the kind of, like, I've discussed this a number of times, but high return on equity, high gross margins, high operating margins, all those sort of things that we would all agree basically indicate a company that's doing very, or a business that's doing very well. When you run those screens, you still pick up stuff like you would have bought a whole lot of for-profit colleges when they got cheap just before they all got wiped out. How would you avoid those sort of things?
The for-profit colleges?
Yeah.
I'll tell you when I got interested in them was when they got cheap.
Yeah, right? Me too.
So, I don't know. So here's a different, this is a tangential thought, but it's somewhat similar. I was listening to Cobra Global on the Twitter machine. He was talking about Europe, and everybody's, well, not everybody, but I've seen people citing like the valuation disparity between Europe and, the U.S. And he was like, sorry, first of all, trigger warning, the people that think that I'm some crazy crony capitalist or socialist from last week because y'all can't listen. That's not my fault. That's yours. He was like, if you look at the EU, they can't, like, a lot of the countries can't actually stimulate because they're bound by EU restrictions on what their deficit is allowed to be. And then the EU is trying to get, like, cute with how much they're paying on the vaccines. So now they're going into lockdown and they're going to be austere. And we have the vaccine and we're not. So to all you that said that I don't know what I'm talking about, guess what? We got a test case. And if I'm right, you can go fuck yourself. And to anybody that said that I had a big head, I want everybody to know that I 100% owe Toby and Jake everything. And you can go fuck yourself too.
I thought you meant physically a big head. Don't worry about that, mate. Your head's proportionate.
I know I'm pretty decent looking. That I'm aware of. So, no, but I don't know. I just think I've gotten into trouble when I've let valuation start to drive my research. That's when I've really started to, like, get myself in trouble.
That's the cause of you looking at something?
Yeah, like, I think, like, when I'm on the fence and I'm like, but it's cheap, that's when I really get myself in trouble.
But here's my question. Like, that's a phenomenon of the last, kind of, since 2010, right? Basically, since 2010, it's been, value hasn't been much of a contributor to returns. It's been at the bottom of every, when you do an attribution of returns, like, this is sadly, but when you do an attribution of returns in any given year, like, valuation has kind of been, it's not there. Historically, that's a little bit unusual. Most of the time, value does pretty well.
Yeah. But that's in any given year, right? I mean,
what's over that last 11 years since 2010, mid-2010?
Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is, like, I fully understand in a wrapper that is mechanical why valuation would be a valuation first decision. In the more discretionary portfolios, I think you're almost betting, like, that I guess that maybe I'll just say what it's done to me, and we'll see. You know, there are some other people that it doesn't do it to, but I think that if I look at valuation, I underweight business quality. And I think that, like, there are a lot of places, the more that I know about the market, that, like, cheap really indicates a lot of problems. And I don't know. I don't have a good answer.
I got someone's thrown a Castle quote from the Business Brew podcast. Some of the best buy and hold investors had their best performance come in high turnover years. Buffett had 80% turnover over 20 years. Same with Lynch. Greenblatt, 200%.
Yeah. So I think I would...
I had some pushback from a pretty smart person on that I'm not... I'm not, like, ready to... I haven't done the work, but, like, this guy is pretty smart, so...
Let's go back to the for-profit college idea. I think if you're going to be sort of a never-sell mentality, which is sort of what we're talking about again, I think you have to really have a business that has long, long sustainability, right? A lot of resilience. And I would argue the for-profit colleges were not playing fairly with all constituents in the ecosystem, which would eventually have led to some kind of defection and problems for them. And when you get into that, I don't think you can hold those forever, and especially regardless of valuation. Whereas if you can find a cleaner shirt business, that to me makes it more likely of a candidate to be in your never sell pile.
The problem for the for-profit colleges, like, they were basically subsidized by the government, right? But they were getting... as sort of all universities are, as all colleges are, they were subsidized by the fact that you could take out a big loan to buy these things. So my thought process at that time was to go through and try and find the ones where basically they were learning a trade. So ESS, which is Los Angeles, that's the ticker. The name of it just escapes me, but it was pretty well known at the time. I asked my wife about it because she's an LA local. She's seen them advertised on television forever. And I thought, well, they help people get trades, like become a mechanic, become something
welding
like that.
Welding, yeah.
Yeah, and I thought, if there's anything that's going to survive this, it's going to be ESS. No, ESS, or ESINQ, I think it is now.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, because it's bankrupt.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. The whole education industry in general is a racket. I sometimes wonder if the average college was public and under the scrutiny of short sellers, whether or not it would still exist.
But you get those times where it's a great business, like it's quantitatively a great business, and here's your opportunity to buy it at a good valuation. And like that's what I perceive Buffett to be doing. He's trying to buy really good businesses when they just get that moment. And so the last example is Apple. Like, it just, for whatever reason, it traded down. I think it was on like 10 times EVE, but something like that. It was just too cheap. And he buys it. And that's kind of what he does. He's not wonderful companies at fair prices. He's wonderful companies at very, very cheap prices. But he's, you know, still buying the wonderful companies out of that bucket. He's not buying the...
like
I don't know that that's not really true, because he says in his private... I mean, I don't know. I wonder if Pilot Flying J was like a really wonderful price.
It gets harder, I think, when you get bigger to find the wonderful price.
Yeah.
So.
And he used to do it with crappy companies that he could take over control of, too, which I wouldn't want that life. I just spent some time talking to Kyle Cerminara, and he seemed to go through some stuff that I'd rather not go through. So turnarounds of inherited dog poo-poo is not exactly my idea of a great existence. I think he'd argue it's not his either.
I got a good comment here. Neversell was a way for value investors to hold on to the best businesses at 30 times earnings when they initially bought in at 10 times. I kind of agree with that. And what I say it, the way that I kind of justify it, I don't do this. This is just, I'm trying to think through if I had something more discretionary, this is something that I might do. The way that you get the right tail is you have to be in these things that start running. And for whatever reason, the business quality gets better over the time that you hold it. And I always give it, the best example of that, I think, is Microsoft. Because Microsoft in 2010, 11, 12, that kind of time, they were pitching it at value investors' congresses, and it was 11% free cash flow yield with 1 year of earnings, revenue declines run by Steve Ballmer. Stock hadn't gone anywhere for 13 years. It wasn't a compounder type stock at that point. And since then, and Satya Nadella had just taken over, so he was unproven. Since then, Satya Nadella is probably a business genius. They've turned it into a software as a service type business, and it's run a million miles, and it probably, it's still roughly fairly valued, even though it's up a lot and the multiple's gone up a lot.
Yeah, I mean, here, I'll say something that triggers people. Maybe like value investing is the disease that gets people to sell that thing at 20 times earnings to buy the next thing at 10 times earnings. It turns into some Brookfield property situation where you get taken under. So I guess it's just like, it's, I just don't, I think these rules are like so difficult. Like, it's so hard to have, I don't know what you do. Like, I'm dealing with it right now with some of my portfolio. It's trading at valuations that I'm not particularly comfortable with. But like, what am I going to do?
Well, congrats to everybody who's got to long-term capital gains.
Yeah.
Tomorrow, mate. Yeah, no, but long-term, you know, capital gains tomorrow.
Today. Woo! But it's like, what are you going to do? Like, I don't know. So I sell it. I got to pay taxes. Then I got to come up with another idea. Nothing is cheap right now. So the opportunity, like, I don't know. I don't know what you do.
I did a little study at one point where I looked at the value gurus versus the value studies. And the idea was to try to figure out, like, is the simple model really the, you know, the floor and not the ceiling of what's possible, as some have argued. And what's interesting, and a lot of this has to do, I think, with liquidity differences in a, you know, back test model that just looks at like, okay, buy this, sell this, and it's not as constrained, especially if you got bigger, you know, and you're Buffett and you're trying to do things, like, you just don't have the same universe. But regardless, one hypothesis I had, like, so to the punchline is that the models trounce even the gurus.
Yeah.
And so, but why? And one hypothesis I had was actually that, you know, if you think about the value guru sort of participating in the irrationality of the intrinsic value being below price and catching the run up and then selling at intrinsic value, perhaps the model participates in that part of the spectrum. But because it mechanically holds for a year or 2 years or whatever, and it doesn't really care about what happens in the interim to valuation, it might participate on the upper half of the irrationality when something runs past intrinsic value and goes up to something that the value guy would have never been able to hold.
Yeah.
And so maybe that's where that extra premium comes from in the mechanical study. It's a hypothesis. I'm not sure if it's true or not, but I find it kind of an interesting idea.
Yeah, the same thoughts occurred to me, not necessarily just against those guys, but that's a reason to hold on to. You definitely have some things that run well beyond where you would buy them. And part of it is like a multiple expansion, and part of it is they have a good earnings print because they turn around. And so they're much, much more expensive than you would buy them or hold them. But you don't have a rebalance state coming up, so you sit in them. And that's there's a, you know, that Graham has that rule where he says, I hold on to it if it's run up 50% or I've held it for 2 years, which I think is one of the few Graham rules that's a really bad one, because what you want to do is hold the things that have run up for 2 years and really, sorry, hold the things that have run up for 50% because you're truncating those winners. And then the 2 year holding period's kind of meaningless. If it's still cheap, you should still be holding it probably.
Yeah.
Yeah,
the guy's not a guru, and he was born in the Depression. So, I mean, it makes sense that maybe his rules are slightly...
He wrote some books that are all right.
That's right. But I don't think
he's
like
do okay for himself.
Okay, but I don't think that Munger and I mean even Munger and Buffett have said they had to morph from him, right? I don't think that like the notion of like the guy wrote a book, so it's timeless wisdom. I think the method of thinking is very timeless, but I don't think that like you can be like, well, it worked in the 50s, so it'll work today. Like that doesn't make sense to me.
But it's the same idea, right? Like, so you could look at John Maynard Keynes. He describes a method of investing that basically sounds like what Buffett does today.
Yeah.
Where he says, you know, look for the compounders, only hold a handful of them that you fully understand. Like, you can read him and it sounds like Buffett. And Buffett's quoted him and it sounds like Buffett.
Yeah. Buffett also learned from Graham, right? And then Buffett morphed. So, I mean, it's like, I think that there's different things for different personalities.
For sure.
So what's value 3.0 then?
Compounders, software as a service.
No, that was 2.0. Compounders.
You
I don't know. I think long short is going to have a pretty good I think long short's probably a pretty good strategy going forward.
Bless up.
Just cuz it's sucked ass for so long.
Well, I just think, you know, I mean it seems to be one of the things that's uncorrelated, right? I don't know. Somebody said it's a new 60-40, and I think that makes sense.
Well, it's definitely uncorrelated. I can attest to that. I got a question here. I think JT and I have talked about this a little bit, but interested to hear what you think now. If you were born 15 years later, would you still be value investors? Look,
15 years later?
I'll say this. I discovered value investing in the late 1990s, and it was a full-blown tech, you know, similar to like what we had late last year, I guess, when dot-coms were teeing off. And that didn't make any sense to me, and value made sense to me. So, yes, I certainly would still be, because 15 years later probably coincides with this current dot-com 2.0.
I think I would have also, just because, you know, my whole life up until I knew even what value investing sort of stood for, I always liked getting deals on things and I hated paying retail. I was always looking to, you know, arbitrage something and feel like I was getting away with something. And I always probably would go more towards cheaper than quality in whatever I was doing. And so when I heard it described is, you know, doing that same idea, but for the partial ownership of businesses, it just made perfect sense to me right away. So that inoculation took. So I think I still probably would have fallen into the value bucket, even if it was 15 years after.
I don't think Graham necessarily defined value as cheap. I think he said that, like, what I got from reading the Intelligent Investor was that you should approach it in this sort of business-like fashion. You should approach it like you're not trying to buy cool products or cool companies, you're trying to buy, you know, streams
of
cash flows.
Dude, dog
but,
shit?
But everybody then, but then everybody no but then everybody says the cheap, right? So if I offered you a Ferrari, like an F430 at $100,000, and it was mint, most people would agree like that's value. But for some reason most value people are like, no, I want the Pinto for $2,000. And it's like, okay, but really rich stuff can also be value. But then when you pitch that, people are like, oh, you've abandoned your roots. It's like, no, I just think that's good value. I mean, it's scarcity accrues value over time. Scarce assets tend to trade at higher multiples. You can find value at higher multiples. God forbid you say that. People are like, did you even read, dude? Like, yeah, I did.
But then Buffett says that too. Low multiples aren't necessarily value and high multiples aren't necessarily expensive.
Yeah, well, people might benefit from listening.
The problem is that I think the difficulty is this. When you look at the cohorts of stocks, the cheaper cohorts do tend to do better than the more expensive cohorts. But the lottery tickets come out of the most expensive cohort. So if you're the kind of guy who can go through the most expensive one and pick out all of the Shopify's and the Amazons and the not Microsoft, because that was cheap, but anything that out of that group, and you can identify the ones that are winners, then you are well and truly paid to do that. If you're not able to do that, and I'm not able to do that, then you need to be going through the stuff where your base rate's a little bit better.
Dude, you say that, but I bet that the strategy that you're thinking of running on the side, where you're like the invincible investor, where you are waiting for temporary hiccups in moaty businesses, I bet you could run that.
Yeah, I think so. But you
that's where I think you're looking. I mean, this is basically rule one stuff. I'm just not sure that I'm fully on board with the bet size that he preaches, but...
The only thing that I would say to that is this is what I'm trying to talk about it now. Like, how do I avoid stuff like the for-profit colleges? Because it didn't look. I just don't have a rule for avoiding that stuff.
I don't know. I think something that I've sort of learned from Elliot and McMurtry a little bit is like they like to talk to people that are short, and they like to understand. Like, I think both those guys are good at understanding the case against what they own. And I think if you really force yourself to write that out and to say, okay, well, how would I argue the short side of this? I think that might be a good exercise.
That's
to
fair.
Make yourself like not even just like a pre-mortem. Like, no, if I was short this, why would I be short? Like, what would I be looking at that would make me not like this?
What about something like Intel is
like
something
Amazon or something like. You could have written a very compelling short of Amazon for multiple years.
Yeah.
And it almost went bankrupt a few times. So it's not like it was even like, this isn't a hypothetical.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, there's these survivors that turn into these absolute monsters. I don't know. It's really
hard.
Yeah,
but a dude like Nick Sleep probably knew that short case and didn't think it was right. And maybe Nick Sleep isn't quite the investor that everybody thinks he is if AWS doesn't come out. But like... he probably still retires.
But you could have bought it cheap too. It fell 94% from, it's fallen 90% plus a few times, but that early, like you got it in the early 2000s down 94%. Maybe you're just like, you know what, this thing is better than it looks here and I'll just grab some here.
Yeah, David Gardner.
I'd be curious to see what the metrics look like though at that point. Like what were you
pretty
actually
bad.
Comparing against?
I doubt
against.
Any of us would have seen it.
Well, you could,
it was an e-commerce bookstore. We would have been like, oh, Barnes & Noble is going to kill that.
What,
Barnes
like, what
Noble's
was the cheapest it's ever traded on price to sales or something?
Yeah,
maybe that would
I'll
be.
Pull that data up and I'll tweet that out in a moment.
Okay.
But that's time, amigas. This was fun. This was a good chat.
Yeah, indeed.
Sorry we didn't take more questions.
Yeah.
I'm not. You guys got a good combo.
I got some in. We got some in. Thanks, amigas. We'll see you next week. Peace. Move with the rhythm, shake it up, stop when the clock hits 13. Sing 1, 2, 3, 4. Cause no one can do it like we do it, like we do it, like we do it.